Joining us today on Pentimental is Ezra Sanzer-Bell. Ezra is a musician and a musical diviner as well, and also a member of Syncbook Press, author of Astro Music. So, Ezra, thanks for being on today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, if maybe you could take that a little further and introduce yourself more for the audience.
Yeah, sure. So, where to begin? You and I met through the Syncbook Press, which is an online medium for sharing ideas, and I wrote a book that came out through the Syncbook last year in April 2014. The book is called Astro Music, and it's really sort of a summary of everything that I came across and studied and tried to get a hold of, you know, starting in 2007 when I was first introduced to synchromysticism, through about 2013 when I started compiling all those materials and trying to put it into the format of a book. So what I talk about in the book is this idea. It goes back all the way into ancient Greece and probably much, much further. It's called the harmony of the spheres, and it's the idea that the cosmos is involved in a kind of mathematical music, and that human music is an attempt on the part of our species to sort of capture the essence of that and communicate it through a medium that's not verbal in the sense that it's not using the ordinary syntax of language. Instead, it's purely mathematical, and that's expressed through the intervals of sound, which we call music. So there was an organization in the late 19th century who I use as sort of the focal point for my studies, and they're called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And so they are part of sort of a long lineage of what's called the Western Hermetic Mystery Tradition, which, you know, depending on who you talk to, has been described in different ways. But some people see the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn as coming out of Freemasonry. Certainly it belongs to the Egyptian mysteries. And what members of this group attempt to do is to go beyond humanity to become more than human. And another way of interpreting that is that they attempt to merge with the gods, right? So I was really curious when I first discovered them what exactly that might mean. And I discovered them through the work of this guy, Paul Foster Case, who had at one time been a member of the Golden Dawn, but had actually split off in the early 20th century and formed his own group called the Builders of the Adytum. So, you know, one of the interesting things about Paul Case is that before he got into these mystery traditions, he was a musician. He was a composer. And he spent time living in New York City, Chicago, and Los Angeles over the course of his life. So he was very much tapped into these major urban centers. And because of that, he was able to actually exert some sort of influence, not only in the small magical circles that he operated in, but also within the bookstores and this sort of the literature of that era. So there's a lot that could be said about Paul Case, but one thing in particular that's really interesting, the way that he found his way into the Western mysteries was through this chance encounter with a man who approached him and asked him if he had ever considered where a deck of playing cards came from. And he hadn't. And that question actually brought him to the tarot, which was sort of the doorway into his initiation into the Golden Dawn and all the rest of it. Now, that encounter happened in 1910. And what I've been trying to do since the publication of my book is to more deeply explore sort of the astrological coincidences that surrounded Paul Foster Case in relation to the work that he brought to the Golden Dawn. See, because as a composer, he started exploring all of these different magical systems connected to the tarot cards that he was originally introduced to. And that included forms of ritual magic. It included meditations upon the Hebrew alphabet and color and all sorts of different magical systems. Astrology was a big piece in it. And what he found missing was music. And clearly music was related to the study of the cosmos, right? So what he attempted to do in his life's work was to integrate musical intervals into this planetary system called the Golden Dawn Ritual Magical Tradition. And the way that works you know, it's kind of complex, and I lay it out really clearly in my book. So I encourage anybody who's curious about this stuff to go deeper and just check out the book. But essentially, the idea is if you were to look at a tarot deck, it's divided into two different sections. You have what's called the major and the minor arcana. And the arcana, the word arcana relates to the idea of something which is arcane or sort of hidden and mysterious. The minor arcana is sort of the traditional playing cards. You know, you have ace through 10, and instead of having jack, queen, and king, you have these sort of these four higher suits, which would be the page, the knight, the queen, and the king. But it's essentially the same thing. That's 56 cards. And then the major arcana is 22 cards. And the 22 cards are sort of in this realm of like a meta space where you kind of see them as both being integrated with the minor arcana, but at the same time operating on a higher dimension of existence. And that's kind of the archetypal domain of tarot. So with those 22 cards, what Paul Case really fleshed out in his work is that those 22 cards correspond to the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And all of the divine names, all of the angels, as well as all of the demons of the Goetic magical tradition could be invoked using alphabet letters. And so what he was essentially trying to do was to, in a ritual context, bring awareness of pitch values to the invocation of angels. So for example, if you were going to invoke the angel Gabriel or Michael, you would look at the spelling of their name in Hebrew. For example, Gabriel would be, you know, Gimel, Bet, Resh. I should really check into this. I believe it's Yod, He, Lamed, something like that. So you would have these musical notes corresponding to each of the Hebrew letters. And as you sang Gabriel, you would have those musical pitches in your intonation for each one of the letters. And that was about the extent of his contribution musically to the Golden Dawn lineage. So, you know, it probably comes off as I'm talking about this, I'm not super familiar with the invocation aspect of Paul Case's work. And that's because I'm not coming from a background of really being interested in practicing Western ceremonial magic. What I am interested in is the idea that these 22 Hebrew letters corresponded to astrological bodies. And that's the piece where I really came in. That's why my book is called Astromusic. What I wanted to do was to look at this idea that there are 12 signs in the Western zodiac and 10 astral bodies, which we call planets, right? So that would be including the sun and the moon. And then you have Mercury, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. So those 10 quote-unquote planets, along with the 12 signs, if you add them together, you get 22. And those 22 bodies, you could say, corresponded to the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And of course, because each of the letters of the alphabet had a musical pitch, so did each of those planetary bodies or signs of the zodiac. Then what I try to do with my work is to explore how one could actually interpret natal charts, or not only birth charts, but also, you know, any given moment in history. You could go onto a website like Astrolabe or planetwatcher.com or something like this. You can just type in a location, a date, a time, and it'll give you the sky chart. And you could see which planets were in which signs. So for example, if Mars was in Sagittarius, well, Mars corresponds to the musical note C, and Sagittarius corresponds to the musical note G sharp. So you could play those two notes together and meditate upon that, and you would be sort of metaphorically meditating upon the energies of both Mars and Sagittarius. You could play them separately, you could play them together, and over time, with that meditation, you would come to form a sort of intuitive understanding of the meaning not only of that interval, but of that interval relative to those celestial energies. This is something that Paul Case didn't go into in his work explicitly, but that I really wanted to sort of flesh out. What I've been doing now since I published the book is to take this work a little bit further and look at how in our culture, especially in, you know, Western American culture, you see a lot of movies, a lot of popular music, which is inspired by the Western mysteries, and especially, you know, with astrology or the names of the gods. So not only Venus, but Aphrodite, let's say, or, you know, not only Jupiter, but perhaps Thor. You know, there would be these various connections between gods and these corresponding gods in other traditions, which map onto them. So using the planets as sort of an anchor for all of these different archetypal projections from cultures ranging all the way through ancient history to modern times. You could sort of have a database through which you could not only study those myths, but also study how those myths correspond to music. So just to give you an example that's a little more practical, there's a song by the Beatles called Here Comes the Sun, and that song is in the key of D major. And in my book, what I talk about is how major chords correspond to a solar energy, whereas minor chords correspond to a lunar energy. And so in this system, the musical note D corresponds to the sun, the planet. And so that the Beatles created a song called Here Comes the Sun in the key of D major, that's an example of being able to sort of match the tone color attribution of D and the color orange to this planet, and then to see how that has actually overlapped with popular culture. And what I'm doing there is I'm not saying that there's some sort of conscious, you know, whether you want to say like a deliberate conspiracy or anything of that sort on the part of these songwriters, be it the Beatles or whoever else it is that these kind of things sync up with. Instead, what I'm saying is that kind of more in the tradition of Robert Anton Wilson, you can actually create a reality filter through which you perceive everything that's ever happened in history in a little bit of a different way. I started doing that with every planet. You know, I was trying to locate composers or songwriters in the popular music sphere that, you know, had created anything that was related to both either planets or the gods or anything like that, and who also had written that song in a key that was relevant to that. So I started coming up with all sorts of material, and that's what I'm hoping you and I can go into today.
Something that struck me about what you said there was the idea of music being implemented in ceremonial magic to maybe get different results. So actually, I've just been exposed to this newer path in the anthropological school of thought called para-anthropology. And it's the cross-cultural analysis and historical analysis of ritual and basically tribes getting effects, or indigenous groups, or various other magically inclined peoples, how they get results for their groups, and investigating whether certain rituals get better results and so on and so forth. And so it's this interesting historical social science analysis of actually a bit what you're talking about. And I'm not a ceremonial magician. I feel like I engage it in a more, whatever I consider magic in my life, I engage with it in a more unconscious kind of way. I like to think that I'm conscious of some of the things I could be doing and how to play with the, whatever, the energies around you and so on and so forth. But I think if we view ourselves as chaos magicians or some variety of those things, there's all kinds of paths you can take towards manifesting. But the point I'm getting at is just the medium of music itself. It is so archetypal in that it does kind of weave together the archetypes themselves through the notes you select, and like you were saying, the intervals and all that. And really, when you think of music, it's really just this chaotic flow through the atmosphere that is being tamed and then perceived by our Fibonacci eardrums and that kind of thing. And the effect that that has on all, entering people into trance states and altered states of consciousness. Richard Merritt gets into this. Other people, of course, have investigated the acoustical effects on the human brain and perception and what we think of as reality. So it really is this really important aspect of reality that people take for granted. Even the corporate junk or glam rap or glam whatever gets put out as kind of, you know, for mass consumption. But even they're playing with some of these ideas, only in a different way, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's funny when you're talking about, for example, like the Fibonacci sequence and how that may have an effect musically. And, you know, there's all sorts of sacred ratios that find their way into music. And a lot of times I don't think the composers are aware that they're doing it. But something that's kind of interesting to note is that there's a lot of different ways to work with music when you're talking about chaos magic. And the way that I'm working with it is not actually dealing with, for example, the phi ratio or the Fibonacci ratio, where there are sacred intervals in music which have actual sort of biological and psychological effects. And that's almost like a category unto itself. What I'm working with in my research is actually more in the realm of mythology and astrology than it is in, I guess you could call it like psychoacoustics. Psychoacoustics is a scientific study of how sound as actual waveforms interacts with the brain as a physical organ to create neurochemical responses, things that can be picked up on by MRIs and that sort of thing. My work is would probably be considered, you know, just sort of like on the lunatic fringe side of the spectrum, and that it doesn't actually land in reality outside of a study of mythology. So it's more maybe belonging to the liberal arts than it is to science. And that, you know, a lot of people get sort of confused about that with my work, because I'll get a lot of people who say, oh, I love what you're doing, check this out. And what they'll send me is pretty much anything except for, you know, material that's actually relevant to what I'm talking about. And that's been really interesting to realize, wow, I don't feel as though I really have peers in this study. And that's, again, one of the reasons I created this book, is I wanted people to have a really clear sense of exactly what it is I'm studying and what I'm writing about and the kind of community that I'd like to attract and create and cultivate. But it's very hard because, as you know, the synchromysticism is already an incredibly small field. And within that, there aren't a lot of musicians. So it's been really a challenge on my end finding other kindreds to work on this material with. You know, but it's neither here nor there anyway. I mean, the thing is, this is a hermetic path. So much of it has to do with just studying by oneself and really contemplating things for oneself. And anyway, just getting back to the idea that popular music may be in some way, you know, directly influenced and affected by these belief systems, that part feels really true to me. I think that we see, especially in Hollywood, you know, I've been tracking something recently. It's a series of synchronicities or sort of overlapping symbols in popular music that, you know, I've been doing a lot of research and I haven't found anybody who's actually alluded to this. So in that way, I feel like I've really discovered something, kind of like I'm this sort of psychic, synchromystic anthropologist who's going into the field of the psyche and trying to pluck out these gems or these treasures and offer it back to people in a way that's presented, you know, such that you can actually kind of understand the deeper meaning of what I'm writing about in my book. So yeah, if you feel open to it, I'd love to share some of that material with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So what exactly is that, if you're open to exploring it?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so where this begins, if you were to get any book on rock and roll music, right, it gives you a history starting in the early 50s, on through present day. And typically there's a few major characters that you're going to read about. You're going to read about Bill Haley. You're going to read about Chuck Berry. You're going to read about Buddy Holly, Elvis. These are the characters. The idea of rock and roll it's a phrase that actually came from Bill Haley. He wrote a series of songs using the word rock in it, right? The most famous one being Rock Around the Clock. So I take Bill Haley as the starting point. His band was called Bill Haley and His Comets. And when I first discovered this and I started really contemplating it, you know, the fact that it's called rock and roll and the guy who coins that is, you know, Bill Haley and His Comets. And of course, one of the most famous comets ever is Halley's Comet, which is where the band got their name. This guy, Bill Haley, prior to that band, he was in, you know, a different band. It was called Bill Haley and the Saddlemen. And they had this, you know, this one hit song, which got them prepared for the rest of their career as Bill Haley and the Comets. And that hit song was called Rocket 88. Okay, so that was in 1951. And so where I started and where I'm going to, you know, start our talk today with this research is this idea of Rocket 88 corresponding to Mercury. Okay, and here's why. So Mercury is the closest planet to the sun. It has an 88-day orbit. So the idea of a rocket is that it's extraterrestrial, right? It starts on our planet, but it leaves and it goes into orbit somewhere. And so Rocket 88 being sort of a symbol for Mercury, and this being one of, potentially some people argue it's the first rock and roll song ever. And he also has, another song called Rock the Joint, but it's this idea of that there's a rock, which is another word for rock is like a planet. So there's a planet that's going around the sun, Rocket 88. The word rocket even has the word rock in it, rock ET or extraterrestrial. So there's this extraterrestrial rock of 88 days that's orbiting around the sun. That's Bill Haley and the Saddlemen. When he comes out with Rock Around the Clock, though, you know, that's where he really took it to the next level. And that was, you know, like the biggest song in rock and roll music. So what I want to talk about here, there's so much material. It's kind of amazing. But the first point is that while Bill Haley was coming out with the song Rock Around the Clock, there was another guy, Chuck Berry, And he came out with this song called Johnny Be Good. These are two of the most famous rock and roll songs in all of rock history. So you've got Bill Haley, Chuck Berry, their two last names being Haley and Berry. And of course, Bill Haley and the Comets is a reference to Halley's Comet, right? There was a guy named Edmund Halley. Edmund Halley, you know, was the guy who discovered Halley's Comet back in the day. That was in 1742. And so people tend to think of it, they call it Halley's Comet, and that's because of Bill Haley and the Comets, but the actual pronunciation is Halley's Comet after Edmund Halley. So instead of Bill Haley and Chuck Berry, you could think of it as Bill Halley and Chuck Berry, or Halley and Berry. And I was thinking about this, and I, you know, without any prior knowledge of the career of Halle Berry as an actress, I just sort of took note of that and kept going with my research. But what I found over the course of the coming months was that actually Halle Berry played an incredibly important role in this narrative. And so that's kind of where we're going to take it. So Halle Berry, you know, in synchromistic literature, one of the things people like to talk about is this idea of a composite character. And that's a reference to any time a actor or actress plays these recurring roles where they keep showing up movie after movie with some sort of underlying archetypal narrative or theme that plays out again and again, right? And the most overt signifier of Halle Berry resonating with Halley's Comet came through this movie that came out in 2012 called Cloud Atlas. And in that movie, she literally has a comet birthmark on her shoulder. She plays in that movie with Tom Hanks. It's kind of an amazing movie, and it's Cloud Atlas, the movie. It's named after a musical composition that's fictional, that's actually sort of the centerpiece of the movie itself. You know, without going into it too much, Cloud Atlas is about a young composer who goes to apprentice with a sort of elder composer, and over the course of his internship begins to imagine himself and the older composer sort of reincarnating through these various different lives. And in each one, he's creating this composition called the Cloud Atlas to go along with it. And as he's doing that, we're seeing actual parallel narratives happening in the movie. So there's several movies sort of crammed into one film called Cloud Atlas, which is exactly the nature of his composition. I really definitely recommend people check that movie out. It's kind of amazing because it shows, first of all, the idea of Cloud Atlas is very much connected to the idea of the harmony of the spheres or the music of the heavens, right? Cloud Atlas is the name of a music composition, and Atlas being a map and cloud being related to the sky. But also, there are moments throughout the movie where he plays a certain musical note or a theme, and it corresponds energetically with the scene that just happened in one of the parallel narratives. If you go back and watch that movie from the musical perspective, it adds a lot. But the reason I brought it up was mainly to point out that Halle Berry has this definitive connection to the comet. And she actually says in the movie, she goes, "Oh, this is my little comet." So in 2014, just last year, Halle Berry was in another, it was a CBS TV show. It was directed by Steven Spielberg, and it's called Extant. It's kind of a ridiculous premise, but she conceives an alien baby and then returns to Earth. And while she's on Earth, her husband has a robot baby that they are raising together. So the premise of this TV show is essentially that she has both like an alien baby and a robot baby, and just the dynamics of that, which is completely crazy. But you find out over the course of this first season of the show that one of the major sort of influencing factors in the pursuit of the alien and the reason that she became pregnant with it to begin with is that there was a meteor that hit the Earth, and inside of it was this strange alien substance which granted this evil Japanese corporate president the ability to extend his life. Though he should have been dead, you know, years prior, he was able to eat this alien substance and stay alive. And so Halle Berry contracts the alien and becomes pregnant with it as a way for this evil Japanese corporate guy to basically extract it and then get the juice from that alien to continue living. So he's pursuing eternal life. So there's something really interesting in the mythology of the comet at large that it has to do with the bringing of extraterrestrial life or intelligence down to Earth. And bearing that in mind, what I started doing was going back through the history of music and trying to track where some of this material, you know, shows up. So, you know, there's a ton of interesting material with Halley's Comet. One thing being that Mark Twain famously was born with Halley's Comet on the same day. And he realized this some point in his life and actually made a comment publicly that, you know, he said, I came in with Halley's Comet and I'm going to die with Halley's Comet, which has, by the way, it has a 76-year cycle. And so sure enough, the day after Halley's Comet had returned, Mark Twain disincarnated at 76 years old. And so that's kind of interesting, that the idea that an extraterrestrial intelligence could actually sort of come through that comet, incarnate on Earth long enough to have some sort of substantial effect, then disincarnate and jump back onto the comet. That's really interesting to me. I spoke earlier about this song by Bill Haley before Bill Haley and the Comets, when it was Bill Haley and the Saddlemen, the song Rocket 88, which I corresponded to Mercury. Well, that song was based on an engine of a car. It was an Oldsmobile 88. Where that car came from, it was actually combined with an Oldsmobile 76 model that had this V8 engine. So they had just taken a V8 engine and put it into Oldsmobile 76. And that was the Oldsmobile 88, which became Rocket 88, the Bill Haley song. Well, 76, of course, is the number of years in the cycle of Halley's Comet. So that's kind of interesting that Bill Haley's first hit song was a reference to this Oldsmobile 76. But anyway, so if you're following the history of Halley's Comet, you'll see that for the longest time, people didn't realize that it was a sort of an orbital body. And that's because it doesn't orbit in the traditional way. When you think of the solar system, you have the sun at the center, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto. And we're actually discovering there's a lot of other smaller planetary bodies. They're considered microplanets, and they're called centaurs. They're not actually planets. They're not big enough to qualify, but they're there. And so that's kind of interesting. But all of these bodies tend to orbit in more or less what's could be seen as like a Frisbee or a pizza. It's kind of like a flat disk. So they're not perfectly flat, but the orbits, you know, are slightly tilted. If you look at Halley's Comet, though, it's in a completely different, it's almost like if you had an X and Y and Z axis, right, which defines a cube. So in math class, right, you have the X and Y coordinates, and that's how you create a graph. And the Z axis is sort of forwards, backwards, rather than up and down or left and right. So if you think of the Z axis and the X axis as being a flat plane, and that's more or less a representation of the plane around which all of our planetary bodies more or less orbit around the sun. Halley's Comet orbits in a way that speaks much more to the Y axis. I don't know if you can visualize that. It's like it's moving on a different plane altogether. And so it seems to disappear completely and then return. And so if you look at the history in human civilization of comets, what would happen so often is that like these great emperors or, you know, people of enormous power, when they would see a comet coming in the sky, that would signal what for them seemed like the end times. So it was a source of fear and paranoia because they felt that it was possible that this flaming body in the sky was actually going to come to Earth and destroy all of life. And in fact, we have plenty of evidence that something like that might have happened, which might have been the root of the Ice Age, right? So there is a real threat. Sean Connery was actually in a movie that came out in 1979 called Meteor, which talks about this. NASA basically has a secret space program where they've put nuclear weapons onto these satellites just outside of planet Earth, and Russia has done the same, and that's so that they can attack Russia from space, or Russia can attack the US from space if that was ever necessary. But now they realize that this meteor is coming straight for Earth, and so they both direct their nuclear weapons towards the meteor as a way to try to mitigate the damage. It's kind of interesting. But anyway, the meteors, over and over and over again, we see meteors as being two things. One is that it's the harbinger of alien life, bringing extraterrestrial intelligence to Earth. And second of all, it is a source of cataclysm, something that could potentially disrupt, destroy, demolish planet Earth as we know it. So all that material is really relevant here. Now, in 1910, when, you know, I mentioned this at the very beginning, but when Paul Foster Case was introduced to the idea of the tarot deck, Halley's Comet was just making a return. So Mark Twain, I mentioned he died at age 76, he disincarnated with Halley's Comet, and simultaneously Paul Foster Case was being introduced to the mysteries. And so from one angle, you can kind of see his initiation into the mysteries as being somehow, you know, at least temporally correlated to the return of the comet. Okay, so that's a little bit of information about Halley's Comet. We're talking about Bill Haley, Chuck Berry, the history of rock and roll, Bill Haley and the comets corresponding to Halley's Comet, so Halle Berry being an intricate part of that. I also want to look at the idea that Halle Berry, she was the first woman to ever win an Oscar, and it was for a movie she created called Monster's Ball. Now, Monster's Ball, one of the things that comes up is that she's intricately sort of enmeshed with this man who's responsible for the murdering of her husband. And over the course, and that's played by Billy Bob Thornton, and she and Billy Bob Thornton play out this romance. And at the very end of the movie, they basically are in love, and the movie ends with them looking up into the sky, right? In the same way that Cloud Atlas ends, the movies end identically actually with Halle Berry and her white husband, which is played by Tom Hanks in Cloud Atlas, but they're looking up into the sky, and in Cloud Atlas, you actually see a little comet shoot across the sky. That movie Monster's Ball with Billy Bob Thornton, that was the first movie where she ever won an Oscar. Interestingly, Lady Gaga, her second world tour was also called Monster's Ball, seemingly an allusion to that movie. So when I discovered that, I started looking in a little bit more to, you know, the history of Lady Gaga, because clearly she's this equally trippy pop culture figure who invokes a lot of esoteric archetypes. And what I discovered is that Lady Gaga was born March 20th, 1986. And that's the month that Halley's Comet was hiding behind the sun. So remember, 1910 was the last time, you know, when Paul Foster Case was introduced to the tarot. 76 years later, 1986, Lady Gaga is born March 20th, and Halley's Comet is right behind the sun. To me, that's really interesting. I looked up Lady Gaga in relation to Halley's Comet, and there's no literature anywhere on the internet. I can't find anything about it. So people seem to have missed this little fact, but it's only behind the sun there for about a month. It's not a long period of time. And if you consider that people in Hollywood, the people who would be designing this kind of material, tend to be really interested in esoteric subject matters, it seems likely that she may have been selected, especially because of this. This would have been seen as a sort of fortuitous birth if you were to consult an astrologer. So that's kind of interesting. Now, there's another thing. There's a second comet, and it's called Hale-Bopp. And it's not the same as Halley's Comet. It was discovered by these two scientists, Hale and Bopp. And Haley-Bopp was discovered in 1996, so 10 years later after, you know, the return of Halley's Comet. And there was all sorts of interesting cultural phenomena that came around that. First of all, and I'm curious to hear, John, do you know, have you heard about this group? They're called Heaven's Gate.
Yeah, I think it was run by, I don't remember his first name, but I think it was Apple White or something. He was very strange. Yeah, the strange fellow with the cracked out eyes, and coincided the mass suicide with the passing of Hale-Bopp.
Totally. So the idea was that he and his cult following, they actually castrated themselves. And then, you know, that was in preparation for this great departure. They basically believed that they were going to ascend to a small UFO that was trailing behind sort of the beard of Hale-Bopp. So this is interesting. Okay, when a comet is traveling through our solar system, we think of a comet as having basically like a bulb at the front and then a sort of tail that goes behind it, which I'm calling the beard. But that the tail of the comet is generated by the solar wind. So the sun is putting out this sort of electromagnetic field, and we call it a solar wind. And as that travels through the solar system, when it makes contact with a comet, the negative charge of that comet, which it accumulated, you know, while it was potentially, I mean, depending on where it comes from, the comet can gain a negative charge in a number of different ways. But what happens is that the negative charge interacts with the positive charge of the solar wind, and it creates that sort of chemical reaction. And that's where the tail comes from. So wherever you see the tail, you know that that's directly opposite of where the sun is located in the sky. So anyway, the Hale Bopp cult called Heaven's Gate, run by that guy Marshall Applewhite, they believe that there was a UFO in the tail, just hiding in the tail of Hale Bopp. And so they were going to castrate themselves so that they would no longer have any sort of sexual desire. And they did that. The next thing they did was on a special date when Hale Bopp was closest to Earth, they put these what are called phenobarbitals, which is a kind of pharmaceutical medication, into applesauce, which in itself is very interesting. The idea of eating the apple or the forbidden fruit goes way back. Also that the guy's name was Applewhite.
And Alan Turing, basically the inventor of the computer, did the exact same thing to kill himself. He laced his apple with cyanide, though.
Oh, interesting. So there you have it. So there's this weird thing of that they committed mass suicide willingly with the idea that they were going to connect with the comet. Now, simultaneous with that, in 1997, there was a major video game that came out. And I'm not personally really into video games. I haven't owned a system in, God knows, probably 15 years. But there was a game called Final Fantasy VII. It was a major game in that not only did it sell a lot of copies, but it was groundbreaking in the sense that it kind of revolutionized the way that games were created and played. It had three discs. It had fully polygonal 3D graphics. But most importantly, especially to me, it made a lot of references to the Western Hermetic tradition, including the evil arch nemesis name was Sephiroth. The character who the protagonist falls in love with is named Tifa, which is short for Tiferet, which is the sphere of beauty, the central Sephiroth on the Tree of Life. You go around trying to collect materia, which gives the characters magic power, which of course is an allusion to the alchemical idea of materia being the essence of something.
You also have Mako energy, which is just mana or ether. There's also a point when you first leave the floating city and you descend into like the swampy area, and there's a giant impaled snake. And I'm forgetting what tarot card you can find it on, but I was just looking at a deck not that long ago that had many, many impaled snakes. It was put out by Squaresoft, who is really like the epicenter for putting out creative role-playing genre games at that time. And it's just so clearly influenced by these deeply archetypal transcultural themes. And so I've always chalked this up that perhaps Japanese authors, generally speaking, are just like more comfortable dabbling with spiritual themes, both because it's more ingrained in their culture and who knows why else, because I guess Westerners are a bit more egotistical about what they look into and what they don't. But it's just interesting to see that even in something that I was engaging with as a youngster was basically laying the groundwork for an understanding of these deeper themes. And I didn't even know what I was ingesting. It's so bizarre in hindsight, actually.
It really is. Now, if you look at the logo for Final Fantasy VII, you'll see it's a comet. It's an all-white background with a comet with the word Final Fantasy VII on top of it. Right as Hale Bopp was coming, just as Heaven's Gate was committing mass suicide trying to merge with it. So why is there a comet there? Well, look at the game. The premise of the game is that an extraterrestrial had come on a comet which crashed on Earth. There was an ancient race called the Cetra, and the Cetra were almost completely annihilated by the impact of this, but those who survived, many of them were then tricked into believing that their husbands or their wives were actually their husbands and wives, when in fact, the husbands and wives had been taken over by this extraterrestrial intelligence and had been turned into a monster, and then the monster would devour their spouses, their children, etc. It was almost completely, destroyed the ancients, and there were almost none of them left before they were able to contain it. And once they sealed it, they basically put it deep into hiding. And the few Cetra that remained eventually gradually had to try to assimilate into human culture. And from then on, the Cetra were almost completely annihilated. And there was only one when you're playing the game, there's only one Cetra left, one ancient person left. And her name is Eris, A-E-R-I-S, which is interesting in itself because Eris is an anagram of Aries, which of course is the astrological age that predated Pisces.
And her original name was Aerith, which is just an anagram for ether again.
Ether, exactly.
And also, funny enough, Sephiroth is the main villain, and throughout that entire game, Cloud, of course, a reference to heaven or like a profane Christ or something or whatever, he's hunting or being the huntsman of Sephiroth the entire game. That's the pursuit. But in pursuing or going up and down the tree or something, he also goes through this bizarre identity crisis that honestly for, I don't know how old I was, I guess 14, 13, I'm forgetting exactly. It's bizarre to go through that game and see that storyline because very little kind of prepared you for that, but it's absolutely a reference to just the individuation process and awakening to yourself or awakening to what reality is. And that alone is a general undercurrent to everything else. And then, yeah, the comet is coming, and Sephiroth, the villain, is actually trying to fuse with the comet. He's calling it to Earth and hoping it hits where he's basically standing.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's the same premise for sure coming through.
What's interesting there is that there were two comets, the original comet, which brought Sephiroth's mother, which is later called Genova. And if you remember, there are scenes where you're walking around inside a kind of laboratory, and there's a strange creature there. I don't know if you remember. It's like a lab creature. And that's called Genova, which, of course, combines the word Jehovah, which is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the god of the Jews from the age of Aries. That combines that with Nova, which means new. So Genova would be the new god. And the backstory to Final Fantasy VII is that after that comet landed, the aliens shapeshifted into the Cetra and tricked members of the Cetra into believing that they were with their loved ones. In fact, they weren't. That whole ordeal, Genova got locked away and was later pulled out by Shinra. Shinra was actually trying to capitalize on the powers of Genova, and that's why they were doing experiments. And who was doing the experiments but an evil Japanese corporation, which is the same premise as Halle Berry's newest TV show, Extant. And if you watch that series, there is an identical, the holding chamber for the extraterrestrial, which Halle Berry gave birth to and which was captured by the Japanese corporation, is the holding chamber is identical to the one in Final Fantasy VII. Really interesting. So I definitely recommend, you know, anybody listening to check that out. But here's the point. The trippy thing about the presence of Sephiroth and Genova in relation to this whole story is that there's another comet coming. And that's what you mentioned. And when Cloud actually kills Sephiroth, Sephiroth then merges with the planetary world soul, but then he becomes one with Genova. And then he essentially casts out a holographic projection of himself with which he can have actual physical contact with the world, which is then at the end of the game, you're not fighting a real creature, you're fighting a holographic projection, which is trying to essentially destroy the planet with this comet. And there's an amazing cutscene at the very end of the game, actually, you know, which we can link up to, which shows the comet coming from outside of our galaxy, flying, or they call it a meteor, but it's flying through the galaxy directly through the solar system, and it starts destroying planets, but it's not any planets. It's actually the planets that it's destroying are labeled, and it goes through Pluto and Jupiter and passes right by Saturn, and it destroys Earth, and it goes straight into the center of the sun. It's an amazing moment, and it just really shows you, you know, there's something about 1997 where in the mainstream consciousness was this idea of a comet which has been to our planet before, which wreaked incredible havoc, and which now is on its way back, and it's here to destroy the world. Now, if you look at the work, there's this guy who's pretty well known in our circles. He was a alternative historian. He's considered to be a total quack by mainstream scientists, but his name's Emmanuel Velikovsky. Do you know that guy?
Yeah, he wrote Worlds in Collision. I've mentioned him once or twice in passing, and he was one of the first real scientists to entertain the idea of a flood and catastrophe theory. It's a type of cosmological view of the universe that there's exploding planets and all this shit that's just kind of shaped how the universe is, order through chaos kind of stuff. Anyway, oh, and real quickly, also Fifth Element came out in 97, which, of course, is a reference to Aether and Quintessence, and has this giant comet infused with this evil spirit about to hit the Earth. And it's stopped, I don't know, I'm forgetting the exact number of seconds away from impact, it gets stopped, but it's very close, and the entire premise is, yeah, this impending comet to hit Earth, so check that one out too.
Oh, I'll have to. Yeah. And isn't there a scene where she's singing in that? Like she's singing a really high note, kind of an operatic.
Actually, that's like, I think that's from, that's either at the end, she like screams and a pillar of light comes out of her mouth. But as far as the singing goes, there was a, there's like a blue man archetypal woman or blue woman sing opera singer that there's like a famous singing scene. I think that's probably what you're remembering, but
that's what I'm remembering. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was also by the same producers of Final Fantasy VII, there was a game that was promoted called Parasite Eve. And I don't know if you remember that, but there was
yes.
a similar
And
premise.
Actually the guy, I have a loose association with a guy that helped, he participated on that project, funny enough. And I used to play that game quite a bit too, but, but yeah, finish your thought on that.
Yeah, for sure. So with Emmanuel Velikovsky, Worlds in Collision, he writes about how Venus was actually a comet that was spat out by Jupiter. It nearly hit Earth, but it just barely missed. And then in doing so, it changed Earth's orbit. It put us on a different axis, and it brought about the major catastrophes that all of the ancient world religions came from. So, you know, that of course brings in the figure of Venus, and, you know, tracing it back, we have Lady Gaga. One of her major songs is called Venus. There's an incredible, you know, chains of synchronicities around Venus. Frankie Avalon wrote a song called Venus, and there was a young man originally born in Liverpool who moved to Australia who did a cover of it, who even Elvis had said, you know, he's like the new, you know, he's the new me. he was a teen idol when he sang this song Venus. It took the world by storm, but then he kind of fell off after that. And what I started, you know, sort of theorizing is that there are these characters who are hand-selected by sort of the movers and shakers of Hollywood, let's say, the people who have the real power and influence. You can just kind of imagine, let's say you had just hundreds of millions of dollars and you can put it into whatever you want. So you're going to create a movie, right? And not only are you going to create a movie, you want to create an actor or an actress. You want to create their whole career. And you're going to do that, you know, because you're, you know, the idea of like a trust fund occultist. Have you heard that expression?
I haven't, but I can totally understand.
Okay.
Yeah, any kind of legacy person, I understand that premise.
So you get a trust fund, or you're born into a family with money, so you don't have any responsibilities.
Crowley was a perfect example of that.
Totally. Yeah, so when you have those kind of resources, you don't have to participate with the world and engage it in the way that most people do. And so that leaves open the question of what do you do with your time? And so a lot of these people get into studying the occult because it's the one thing that still seems off limits. You can't buy it. You know, you're not even sure if it's there, but that you have, there's all sorts of hints that it might be there. And so part of the legacy of people in this position, which I believe in a big way is sort of operating at the subterranean levels of the, you know, Western media, specifically in the United States, but also a little bit in Europe, what you start to see is that there are all of these actors and actresses who have been set up from the very beginning for whatever reason. We don't even really know why they're chosen. I'm sure it's a case-by-case basis, but they're set up to resonate with certain ideas. For example, Halle Berry with the idea of Baphomet. She represents the comet, which is the bringing of spirit to Earth, or the bringing of the comet, the harbinger of extraterrestrial life, to Earth. And she also, if you think about her, she's half black and half white. The majority of her roles, she's in love with a white man. There's a really interesting interracial theme, which I believe is significant, because if you read a lot of the literature of esoterica around race in relation to mystical imagery and symbolism, you see that so often the black race is associated with the unconscious and the white race is associated with consciousness. And that's very much limited to the Western Hermetic tradition. It's not an idea that I subscribe to as anything other than sort of a product of their imagination, if you will. So, you know, I'm really careful when I talk about this stuff to point out I'm not promoting a racist ideology, but I'm just sort of noticing the significance of certain symbols. And so often you will see that idea of that, for example, rock and roll music, Bill Haley, Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry was black, Bill Haley was white, but they were both playing rock and roll, and they were both huge influences. And when you combine them together, you get this woman, Halle Berry, who, you know, syncs up with Cloud Atlas and the idea of the harmony of the spheres. She also brings in the comet, which is the one type of astral body that of the, you know, we talked about at the beginning, the 22 Hebrew letters corresponding to the 12 signs and the 10 planets. Well, what's missing there is the comets. There's no musical note or color or any sort of metaphysical attributions. The comets, what's up with that? And so that's a real loophole in the tradition of Western ceremonial magic that, you know, doesn't really get spoken to.
Moving towards a conclusion here, what, I guess if you're going to summarize as best you can, paraphrase as best we can, how would you put the intersection between music and magic into context? How would you describe the relevance of those two things overlapping? What does it accomplish for you? What do you think people can get out of it? And what is the point of, I guess, engaging in this type of practice anyhow? What do you think is the main purpose, or how, what can people get out of it?
Sure. So all the material I've just been talking about is just to sort of like create a point of intrigue or something to stimulate the listener so that they can actually understand sort of how this worldview can be experienced. But as far as actually using it, that's the second half, almost like I could do a whole nother show about that. But the basic premise is that you are being gifted through this tradition the opportunity to work with music as a magical device. And what I mean by that is that there is a very clear system of correspondence whereby first of all, a zodiacal chart, a sky chart, can be converted into music, right? So as a composer, if you understand the principles of harmony and rhythm, you can take these constraints and you can create music out of that, which means you can create a piece of music that would be an iconic representation of any moment in time. Secondly, it also offers a means of translation, which means that any word that has ever been written in the English language or in Hebrew or in Greek or in Latin or in French or in German or in Spanish, any romantic language can be converted into Hebrew letters, which can be converted into musical notes, which means that you can, for example, spell out the name of somebody who you wish to work with. So John, I could take your name, J-O-H-N, and convert it into musical notes. So I'll do that right now. J is F, O is A, H is C, and N is G. So you have F, A, C, G. Those four notes are a musical melody. Here, I have my melodica right here. I'll just play it. F, A, C, G. Sound like this. So now I have a melody that spells your name. Now, in magic, you have two things. You know, you could use it for meditation and blessing. If I wanted to meditate upon who you are or your essence, I could take your full name, your first and last name. I could also study your astrological chart. I could find the overlap. So, for example, if, you know, with F-A-C-G, I could see whether or not there are, for example, C corresponds to Pluto, to Mars. So I could see if Mars lands in G, which is Scorpio. So if you had Mars in Scorpio, that would be a point of interest, and I might work with that. And I might create a composition that emphasizes that C to G interval. Another thing you can do is to take an entire group of people that you wanted to harmonize. For example, at my workplace, there are a number of people there. I could translate all of their names into musical notes and then attempt to create a composition using those melodic sequences, so that it's kind of like a puzzle. You would have to see where each piece fits, and out of that I would have a composition that showed the connecting points. And it's really interesting to do that. You notice a lot of things. It's a lot like doing a tarot reading or studying astrology, where you can look at which planets are in which signs. You look at the person themselves and you say, oh, I can totally see how your sun is in Pisces and your moon is in Aquarius, and oh yeah, it really makes sense, you know, that your Mercury is conjunct Sun, because, you know, you're very talkative and the way that you express yourself is very similar to your Piscean essence with Sun and Pisces. So just as you could do that with the sky chart, you can also do that with this technique of musical divination. So yeah, I mean, I hope that sort of at least answers it a little bit.
I guess I'm trying to tether magic with art more and more, and I see the effects, and why I'm doing it is almost inseparable after a while. I guess I subscribe to the Alan Moore definition that magic is anything that can alter consciousness to a degree where I guess some people would use it to manipulate, but other people are just using it to open up people to a different point of view or state of mind or perspective. And that's sort of what the world needs, I think, is just people learning how to see problems or situations or themselves from different perspectives. And whatever your preferred methodology for engaging with reality or quote unquote magic, even science is fucking magic, even everything is magic. It's all a perception thing and how you organize reality in your own head. But also, again, I don't think living in your own head is completely the way to go. There's some weird objective qualities to the universe that we have to know how to be in touch with and in rhythm with. And I guess that's what music and these sorts of systems teach you. And so the intersection between them for me makes like perfect sense just on an intellectual level. But for people that are more musically inclined, I'm sure they just kind of feel that.
Right. Yeah. It's not required. You know, you don't have to get into ritual magic to compose a good song, but I think that it opens up new. See, the thing about songwriting is that we get habituated to writing in certain ways. So, for example, we're taught, oh, okay, if you want to play a song, these are the kind of chord progressions that are allowed. These chord progressions are not allowed. This kind of motion melodically is appropriate. This kind is not. So you are very early on sort of indoctrinated with the pedagogical limits and then also stylistic limits in mainstream music. So depending on what kind of music you've been exposed to, you're going to basically have an unconscious belief as to what is possible, what's permitted, and what's not. What this system allows you to do is to work with melodic patterns, which you might not normally think of, in many cases, which you definitely would not have come up with, and to try to harmonize them and find ways of working with them, which then lead to entirely novel musical creations. And so it's a really great source of inspiration for people who feel stuck and are trying to find new ways of exploring music that still have meaning, right? That aren't just saying, okay, we're going to, you know, just come up with a completely random algorithm of musical notes and then compose for that. That can feel kind of dry and not very interesting. So this is a way of, if you have a loved one or if you have an enemy, I mean, there's where the black magic comes in. If you have an enemy and you wish to harm them, you could translate their name into musical notes and create a little musical icon of that and then sigilize it and then do your work that way, right? It goes both ways because essentially what you're doing is you're working with energy. And I'm a firm believer that it's all in your imagination. So, you know, there are subtle effects that happen through magic, and to create a musical icon and then send energy of love and blessing is essentially to send that energy of love and blessing to that part of yourself which that person represents. And likewise, if there is a person who you consider an enemy, whose values you clash with, then when you're creating that sigilized musical icon as a representation of them and sending hatred and negativity towards that, you're essentially sending that energy towards that part of yourself. So that's just an interesting thing to keep in mind, but also, you know, to realize that the imagination it's not just in your head, and it may very well actually have some sort of ramifications or some sort of impact beyond just your own imagination. And that's the really trippy part, is that our imagination is non-local. It's the sort of the quantum understanding.
Right. And that's the thing. We have to tie this back to what our view of is consciousness in one sense or another, because if we just take the mainstream or adopt the mainstream perspective that everything is in your head, that it's all produced by your brain. And I'm willing to concede that there's stuff going on in my head. There's no doubt about that. My question is, what about stuff like near-death experience or out-of-body experience, where they have eyes to see with no eyes, they have ears to hear with no ears, and they see exactly what happens and recite it back later to these doctors and professionals who are meant to remember, are trained to remember things for a living. That's what they're trained to do, is to have good memories and to document what's happening around them. And so when you have these 99.9% correspondences between those events, it's like, well, okay, your consciousness seems to be synced up to something much deeper. And then through artistic form, it seems to be embodied through that. And at the same time, then you're the conduit that helps give shape to it and creates permutations of whatever current you're a part of. But it's all, I mean, that's what gives rise to infinite novelty, but also consistency to things at the same time. Or at least that's how I perceive it. So that's the challenge. And whatever these models and these approaches to thinking about how to use our minds, I think, have all kinds of validity within that perspective of, oh, there is a non-local element to it. And it's not just the behavioralist input response type of perspective on who we are and what we are and that kind of thing, and meaning specifically.
Absolutely. I mean, I know that we're wrapping up here, but the final thing I would say is that, you know, in my book, right off the bat, one of the things I talk about is near-death experiences. And the there's a book by this guy, Scott Rogo. His whole premise, he's a parapsychologist who looked at the role of music in near-death experiences, people hearing sounds, hearing the swelling of musical tones, sometimes of entire symphonies, of angelic choirs. And he just goes report after report after report. It's called The Casebook of Otherworldly Music. And, you know, the premise of the book is that basically there is this sort of non-local music, which presumably you could call it our soul or consciousness, but it's specifically our localized individuated consciousness makes contact with at the moment of sometimes of sleep, sometimes of near death. And so it raises all sorts of questions. It's like you said, people without ears to hear or without eyes to see will make contact with sound and with color. And it just lends evidence to the idea that, I mean, if that's happening right now, this is probably something that's been with human beings since the beginning of time. And that most likely the idea of the harmony of the spheres, or the idea that there are musical tones being produced by each planet as it goes around the sun with its own unique orbital frequency, that all of those sounds together would create a kind of symphony. That idea probably came out of these direct Gnostic experiences of the ancient Greeks or ancient Egyptians, or, I mean, who knows how far that myth really goes back, that they may have had that experience and tried to create a myth out of it to capture something which was essentially either a neurological phenomena or a psychic or spiritual phenomena. We don't know yet. There's not enough research, but there is definitely something that happens to human beings, which is hearing music in your head, which has no acoustic source, but which is palatable, which has often a sense of deep mystery and sounds otherworldly in a way, you know, that nothing we've ever heard could ever have matched up with or produced.
Okay, so I know you've gotten into your newer work a little in depth already, but maybe you just want to leave us with any parting shots or whatever to be on the lookout for.
Yeah. Well, I've kind of taken a break right now. I was invited by the Portland School of Astrology to speak, and I actually turned it down because what I realized is that I've spent all this time sort of preparing material to present, and yet simultaneously, like, I feel like I'm just on the precipice of discovering the actual body of my work. So I was happy to do this interview with you because it feels a lot more casual, but I'm sort of stepping back from the position of like offering people the content of my research. And it's not for the purposes of secrecy. It's more just to really allow it to incubate and fully develop. So right now, I mean, I have 180 pages of material that I wrote that I was actually thinking of putting into another book and publishing, but I'm just sort of holding off and continuing my research to try to deepen my understanding of this material before I, you know, create the next book. So yeah, nothing really to report for now. People can check out my website though, www.audiomancy.net. You can find a link to the book there. You can also, I gave a presentation last year for the 4th of July that talks about the connection between the Sirius Dog Star and the Masonic American National Anthem, which is a pretty cool talk. Also, an interview I did on 42 Minutes through the Sync Book Radio about the Minotaur and the Labyrinth, the connection to the 88 constellations and the 88 days of Mercury. There's also a free tarot deck that's really beautiful that you can access there. You can save the images and print them off yourself if you want. So that's kind of a cool offering. Yeah, aside from that, you know, not too much. People are welcome to get in touch with me through the website. I love talking with people about this stuff. So if anybody wants to talk further, just check out the website.
Okay, Ezra, thanks again for being with me.
Totally. Thanks, John.